We have four bills that we are preparing. We have notice for a public hearing and work session. So we'll start out with Senate Bill 237 and open up a public hearing on that. And Dennis, would you like to give a short overview?
Senate Bill 237 increases bond amounts for certain nonprofit organizations who elect to be reimbursing employers. Excludes nonprofits of under $100,000. There's no revenue impact, and as of 12:40, fiscal advises there may be a potential fiscal impact, and they'll advise as soon as possible.
There may be a potential.
Maybe.
Okay. Sounds very good. Well, welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself and present your testimony.
Thank you very much. Chairman Nelson, my name is Renee Bryant. I am the tax manager for unemployment insurance tax at the Employment Department. With me is Rob Edwards, who is the manager of central operations for the tax section. And we have here what we think is a very minor correction to legislation, which would make our statutes more equitable as they apply to the bond deposits required of nonprofit entities. Mr. Edwards is the expert on this, and I am going to let him testify to the exact effect of the bill.
Thank you. Chair Nelson, members of the committee, good afternoon. As Renee mentioned, my name is Rob Edwards. I'm the manager of central operations for the tax section of the Employment Department. What we're proposing here in Senate Bill 237 is an adjustment to the percentage that we use to determine the bonds that are posted by nonprofit employers. Nonprofit employers have the election of either being taxpaying or what we call reimbursing. This means that if someone files an unemployment claim, and it's the benefits are awarded to that person, the nonprofit reimburses the trust fund dollar for dollar for those amounts. In order to ensure that the trust fund is reimbursed, we do require a bond or deposit. Unfortunately, sometimes nonprofits do go out of business, and we would like that the trust fund not be left unreimbursed for any amounts. What this bill does, we think, is increase decrease some inequities in the present bond structure. It's a graduated structure. Some of the examples that we have are an employer with a payroll of $99,999 would be required to file a bond in the amount of $2,000, but an employer with $1 more in payroll would be required to file a bond in the amount of $1,500. So it actually goes down. So we're looking at trying to build a little more uniformity in the bond structure. The other issue, of course, is equity. If a nonprofit does go out of business without paying all of the reimbursements, those amounts are picked up by other remaining taxpayers in the system. Are there any questions?
Yeah, do we have any questions here? I'm still sort of studying on this thing here. Dennis, you said there was potentially a fiscal impact. What
this would advise? She cannot advise.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, according to our estimates, and they are estimates only, we're anticipating that there might be a net increase to the trust fund of about $180,000 a year due to the additional funds that we'd be able to collect that are not now collectible based upon bonds that are insufficient. We sent that information over to Legislative Fiscal, but something happened in the transmission or they didn't consider, I'm not sure, but I understand as of today that they had intended to send something down.
Okay. But the nonprofits will basically be paying more money than some of them. Is that what you're saying, or how does that work?
Chairman Nelson, excuse me, thank you. No, they won't be paying more money. The taxes assessed are going to be the same no matter what. For instance, if I make a claim for unemployment insurance benefits and I receive $3,000 of benefits and I'm a former employee of a nonprofit, those taxes are attributable then to the nonprofit and they are assessed to that nonprofit to pay. So the bond may have been only for $1,500. We're making it more equitable so that we can get a larger bond and have a greater surety that those funds will be covered in the event the nonprofit can't pay.
Okay. Any questions from the committee?
Well, yes, actually, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Senator Walker.
I have Attachment A in front of me, and it says calculating bond amounts, current law. payroll and percentage, but I don't have anything that tells me how you're going to calculate it under the proposed law.
Senator, or Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, it's going to be a flat 2% of the payroll for an annual period.
All right. So that's how some of these, if I might follow up, Mr. Chair, that's how some of these organizations will pay less and some may pay a teensy more?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, that's correct.
Okay.
Any further questions? Anything in the chair? Since we do have a potential fiscal impact, we maybe should wait for that so we won't go into work session on this. We'll get all the information in and see what comes back on that. That'd be good.
Thanks.
Any further questions of these folks? Thank you very much, and we'll get this information and get this thing set up for a work session. Thank you. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 237. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 244. Dennis.
Senate Bill 244 removes Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission, renames Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission to Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries. No, and there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay. Jim, please introduce yourself and start.
Afternoon, Mr. Chairman. James Hamrick. I'm the Assistant Director for Heritage Conservation at the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I basically manage the current Oregon Pioneer Cemetery Commission program. This is a commission that was moved into parks from in 1999. It had formerly been over at DAS for a number of years and was moved over to parks in 1999 and came under my jurisdiction. And when the bill was created in 1999, at the time the authority that the commission had extended to Native American cemeteries. And so what happens is that the commission, which is a very active, active commission, has been doing work programs and retreats and other sorts of things. And over the last year, they decided that one of the things in their work program would be to ask that the legislature change the word pioneer to the name Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries. They did this because as a part of that statutory mandate, it's now over Native American cemeteries. We have a Native American commission member, and so is pretty much the idea was to acknowledge that, in fact, the difference between pioneers and Native American cemeteries. We don't believe that the name change will diminish the focus of the commission on pioneer cemeteries. I think the way they have a lot of business and the two mix really pretty well. We really see the name change as better representing the commission's mandate, which is to help protect both Native American and pioneer cemeteries. The original legislation's sponsor, former Representative Kevin Mannix, was consulted when we were thinking about putting this bill together, and he believes that the current bill is, quote, an appropriate way to address, unquote, the issue. So, Mr. Chairman, be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions of the committee? Concerns? Yeah, Senator Byer.
Mr. Chair, I see the administrator said that there's no revenue or no fiscal, but there's got to be some costs associated with changing names, stationery, business cards, everything involved. It can't be. I can't believe it's a zero fiscal.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Byer, you are correct. There will be some. We will, in fact, have to change the stationery and business cards. And I'm sorry that that the fiscal impact said zero, because there will be a minor or small fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, yes. What's the source of the funds?
Ms. Chairman, Senator Beyer, the Parks and Recreation Department, this particular commission receives Measure 66, which is the lottery funds that commission that runs the department now. So it's other funds. They call Parks and Natural Resource Fund.
Any further questions? Oh, any further witnesses? I have none signed up. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 244. Open up work session on Senate Bill 244. Any concerns within the committee?
No, Mr. Chair, I would just like to make one comment. I see Karen Wells in the audience, and her husband, former Representative Larry Wells, used to get very irritated with all the name changes every session, so I want you to let him know I'm cognizant of that, but I think this is appropriate.
It's my understanding that Karen was contacted concerning this. Is that that is correct, isn't it, that you were contacted concerning this? There were concerns there that they were brought forth, and so there is another bill out there that we do have some concerns about, as I understand.
Yeah, that's correct, Senator.
All right, so the chair would entertain a motion, or the chair will move that we move Senate Bill 244 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and if there is a unanimous vote within this committee, that it be placed upon the consent calendar.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think you may see some resistance on the floor because of that issue, name changes. I know that Senator Fisher and a committee we earlier is objecting to all name changes. Mm-hmm. And it's a legitimate concern. We're constantly changing names, and they aren't without fiscal impact. I mean, they might be Measure $66, but they're still, that's dollars that are going to be used to, you know, change names that could be done going for other purposes.
I could remove it from the consent calendar and just allow it to have a discussion. Let's take away the consent calendar issue and just move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is that satisfactory with the committee?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hearing no objection, so ordered. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 244.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, James.
And
I'll carry that, I guess.
You're the cemetery guy?
I am the cemetery guy. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 250. Dennis, would you like to?
Senate Bill 250 authorizes state agencies to utilize performance reporting information system to measure workforce performance. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Okay. But,
we need before.
Graham and Terry. Are you in the? You're in the. We've heard this one before. Yes. Welcome again. Were we really tough on you last time? Please introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Graham Slater, Administrator of the Workforce and Economic Research Division in the Employment Department. And just a quick reminder on this bill, we were here last week. I know Senator Metzger wasn't part of that. So three primary things that this bill would do: start the process of shutting down that shared information system, kind of complete the process of replacing it with the performance reporting information system, which does many of the same things but does them better under the Workforce Investment Act and so on, and then finally allow greater flexibility than PRISM, or Performance Reporting Information System, currently has. If you remember, we did ask for an amendment essentially deleting nine words, and we talked through those last week, and I just want to focus on the purpose of that amendment. One of the purposes of us bringing this Senate bill is to broaden and make more flexible the opportunity for workforce agencies to participate in PRISM. And I guess I'll just say, somewhere between us submitting the legislative concept and then preparing for the testimony last week, that one section clearly didn't achieve what we had hoped. Somewhere in there, some wording changes took place, and fortunately, before we did our first testimony, we caught that, which we'd have caught it a few weeks earlier. But anyway, the amendment simply would restore our original intent, which is that any workforce agency that wants to have access to this information can have that access if our department director and the governor's office agree that they're a valid participant. So we don't want to close the door on people using this information, figure out if their programs are being successful. I also brought back some questions or answers to questions that some of your committee members asked last week, and one I think was Senator Beyer, who asked whether general funds were used to pay for PRISM, and you can see in the little table at the bottom of my testimony, we asked them when they made their last PRISM payments, what was their source of funding, and for two of the departments it was not general fund at all, and then for two of them there was some percentage of general and some percentage of federal and other. And my additional comment is, as you know, this bill makes no changes to any of that. So the bill itself is simply trying to do the making it more flexible kind of stuff. It doesn't charge them more or tell them where to pay the money from. But Senator Beyer, hopefully that answers your question from last week.
Mr. Chair, it prompts another one. The SIS system that you're replacing, were they also billed for that system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, they were. And the costs are essentially the same. Again, the one system's replacing the other is the plan. Okay. And then turning to page two of the written testimony, Senator Beyer asked about one particular part of it. Again, not a part that's not a part of the statute that's being discussed in this bill, but something that caught his eye, and that was whether we actually charge for the sharing of the reports. And certainly in the history of PRISM, we have not done that, and we really don't see any situation where we would, partly because it's all on the website anyway. And checking with staff who are still around, none of us are aware that we've ever charged for that part of SIS either. Once those reports are prepared, they're shared with the partner agencies, and under PRISM, they're shared on the website. So we don't really see any situation where we'd be charging for those. I suppose there could be somebody who wants 10,000 copies, and we may decide to do that, but realistically, I don't think that'll happen. Senator Beyer, I think it was also who asked about who decides if it's reasonable. I guess I'm jumping to my third bullet here, and basically saying that our staff, both in research and the budget area and the computer area, came up with the budget outline of how we would fund PRISM, and staffing and computer time and all those things, took it to the PRISM steering committee, and that committee is made up of representatives of all the agencies that participate in PRISM. So obviously they're looking at it, not only are the numbers reasonable, but are we willing to pay that much for it? And the answer obviously last time around was yes, they decided it was reasonable. And that's exactly the method we would use in the future, is everything would go through that steering committee, which is mostly agency director level participants. Jumping back up to my second bullet there, where it says SB 250 makes a small change in current language. Initially, we were only saying that partner agencies would share in the cost of maintaining the system. And part of that reason was that we had some federal grants that helped us develop it and write it. So that was a good boost to us. As we go forward, we're just suggesting that the language should change to say that the partner agencies would also share in the cost of future developments. However, as of June 30th, we've not only got phase one as is planned up, but also phase two will be done. So all the basics are done, and a lot of the actual first round of enhancements are done. So there are no plans during this next biennium to do any further development. So as far as the next 2 years, it becomes kind of a moot point. And then finally, I think Chair Nelson asked about the value of the information, and I shared with you that it is a way to figure out if those people who are served in the workforce system actually find jobs, if their wages increase, and so on. I would also want to say that the Workforce Investment Board directs the measures that will be in PRISM. My job in the research area basically is to count the numbers, do the analysis that the board subcommittees and then finally the board itself asks us to do. So there's probably five or six others over the long term that they'll add to this. The three that I mentioned are the ones that are already completely up and running. Did they find a job? Did they stay employed for four quarters? And did their wages go up over a period of a year? Chair Nelson, you asked a little bit about kind of some concrete examples of how this has been used, and remember that the PRISM data have only been up for a period of months, but I did find out that they were already used in setting the expected levels of performance for the one-stop workforce programs across all the regions. Of course, the benefit there is that we don't have all the agencies measuring the things that they want to measure, and then you're trying to compare apples and oranges across different regions of the state. This has everybody on the same playing field, so we really can look and say, something's different in Pendleton than what's going on in Coos Bay. Is that because of the economy? Is it because of the way the workforce system's running? What's underlying that? And this, we believe this program allows us to do that. But if everybody was doing their own thing, we wouldn't be able to. I believe that you have a written testimony from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and then Terry is here from the Department of Community Colleges.
How big is your business budget anyway?
It's roughly $440,000 for the whole biennium.
$440,000.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any further questions of this witness? Terry?
Mr. Chair, did I hear you say correctly that you're not going to make any changes to this system so that, for instance, Department of Education, Department of Human Services that have general fund in this system will not be billed in the next biennium?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, when I said no changes, I meant no further development in terms of the computer software and the analysis work.
Will they be still be billed for this? It was $132,000. I remember right that you told us last week that each of these other agencies are billed. Will they still be billed this next biennium?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, they'd be billed because that portion was for the maintenance of the system, the staff time, the computer time. So $440,000, rough numbers, is what it costs to actually run the system. The things that they would not be billed for, and they weren't in the past, is for developing the system from scratch because we had the federal grant, or for enhancements, improvements. But just the ongoing running of the system, they would share in the cost. We don't know the exact amount, again, because this bill opens up the opportunity for more partners, so the cost to some agencies would go down if more partners come in.
What happens if this bill goes away? What happens if this bill doesn't pass? Will these agencies still be billed for these services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if we do not run the PRISM program as it is, no, the agencies wouldn't be charged. There would be nothing to charge them for. If they wanted similar information, to know whether their programs were being successful, we would probably have to charge them then more on a case-by-case basis, just for the computer time, as I mentioned to you last week, the staff time and so on. That would obviously remove some of the benefits that I've outlined, because it would be only the agencies that want to measure it would be maybe doing it once a year or whatever. I would also say that the Workforce Investment Board, which includes some legislators on it, mandated under WIA, requires these things to be measured. So, I mean, that side of it is not my research area of, I guess, involvement or expertise, but I think there would have to be a discussion there between yourselves and the board, just to say we don't want those things to be measured anymore, because the board certainly has indicated that they do. But.
Further questions?
No, no further questions.
Just some doubts, sir. Okay, Terry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Johansson, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and I'm here today to speak to you about Senate Bill 250 because we are one of the participating agencies and one of the users of the data. So, as you undoubtedly know, CCWD is the administrator for the Workforce Investment Act and post-secondary Carl Perkins, as well as the oversight organization agency for the 17 Oregon community colleges. All of those groups and funding streams are part of the workforce system and part of the users for these data. Each of the agencies, of course, have to collect different pieces of this data to report to their funding streams and to their mandates. But what the SIS system did, and now the PRISM system does better, is allow us to aggregate these data across the various and very complicated mix of agencies that deliver workforce services, and allow us to take a look at Oregon's investment and and what are the outcomes, at least in these three measures so far, that the PRISM system reports on, of our shared and aggregated effort across all of these various and sundry agencies and funding streams and programs that make up the workforce system in Oregon. I'd like to just bring to you, and I think, Senator Nelson, you might have had this question at the last hearing, for an example of some way we may have used this system that we wouldn't have, we would have been able to do it, but it would have been much harder. CCWD had in its last budget a budget note that required CCWD, the Employment Department, and the workforce-related programs from DHS to prepare a report that would report on the coordination and prioritization of workforce services and whether or not there was duplication of effort across those agencies in workforce services. We were able to create the data and analyze the data that we needed to be able to report back to you all to answer your question by using that aggregated data out of CIS. It allowed us to take that look across those agencies and look at an analysis of the individual participants, not by name, but by number, to see if we were duplicating across those. If so, what were the services an individual was receiving? Were they duplicated or were they cumulative in nature, so the person would be ultimately successful and be able to get a job and hopefully have wage gain and all of those things that we're required to report on. Currently, the PRISM system reports on three of the shared workforce performance measures that the Oregon Workforce Investment Board has asked us to work towards and to report on. There are several more that we think the system will be able to provide reports on. And as Graham said, the PRISM system is rather new. We've only had these data up for a short few months, already used them in this one example. But the executive staff from the participating agencies and workforce groups meet regularly in something we call the Workforce Policy Cabinet. And these data are the kinds of pieces of information, I think, that will help us across the agencies be able to, A, look at what some of the outcomes are, and B, be able to have the conversations around how we can leverage and do value-added work across those agencies. So for us, PRISM is important. We are often asked to be accountable and to be able to report out whether or not people are experiencing the outcomes we're after out of the services we deliver, and this is a system that allows us to do that. It's matured to a point that it is now useful to us, and so CCWD has made the determination that we will continue to pick up our share of PRISM costs through our federal dollars.
Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, the problem we're struggling with is our co-chairs and our people in Ways and Means have, you know, indicated to the committee chairs that we're in a very difficult budget crisis, and we're, you know, if we were going to choose this program versus state police or something, I mean, are we down to that point? I don't know if we are or not, but I mean, I think that's a concern that's been expressed to us, and that's why we're asking you all these questions. So Senator Walker has.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Terry, Ms. Johansson, you indicated that as a budget note last session, you were asked to prepare a report on duplication of effort.
Mm-hmm.
Did you prepare that report?
We did, and it was delivered to the e-board. Now you have me. I can't remember which meeting, but it was delivered, I think, not last e-board meeting, but the meeting before, and we do have that, and it is available. I'd be glad to get it for you if you'd like to see it.
Can you just highlight for me, was there a duplication of effort? Were you able to streamline the program, save money by doing that, and find that the program does benefit?
I think the primary finding out of that report was that there were cumulative efforts, that indeed an individual person may have received services across various agencies, but not duplicative services. In other words, services that combined made the mix of services a person needed to be able to move on to their next step, whatever outcome it was they were working toward. Of course, we ran across, you know, a few situations where there were questions, and that did give us the data to be able to go back and say, you know, what's going on here? How can we tweak these program designs so that we have more efficiency across that? So, the theme and the outcome of the report was that cumulatively our services are working well across those, and by being able to look at these data in this way, we were able to take that snapshot, answer the questions asked.
Mm-hmm. And I had a follow-up question. Thank you. And so, I think what you're telling me is that your report showed that the program is working the way it should, and that people are getting back out to work, and this is a way to help get people paying taxes again and bringing home money to their families, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we certainly think that it is working as well as it can in these economic times. Of course, you know, there have to be jobs for folks to go to, but I think that the data really shows that people who receive these services do make progress to their next steps and do get the training and or other services that they need to be prepared to get those jobs and to be successful in them.
Well, and one final question. Thank you. And I think that's important to hear, because it's easy to say, well, your program's costing 400-some thousand out of the general fund, and that's a lot of money. But I think that the benefits of the program are far greater than 400,000 in terms of what they offer to Oregonians and getting better employment and putting more money into the general fund for us to use.
Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, we feel it's important for us to be able to take those looks at what the outcomes of our work are so that we can tweak them where necessary.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chair, maybe my comments be more appropriate for work session if there's going to be a work session, but I guess first of all, I think it's probably not 400,000 general fund. It's probably 120,000 general fund dollars, because if you look at the 30-20 and 30% of the general fund, we don't know what the source of some of the other funds are in these other agencies. But I would argue that it may only be $120,000, but I, you know, that's two teachers. And where are we going to get more value out of the general fund dollars? Is it going to be looking at whether or not a training has worked out, or is it going to be having two more teachers in the classroom someplace? And I'm not saying this is not a good program. This is probably a great program. The issue is the general fund dollars. And if there's a way that Department of Ed, Department of Human Services can fund these programs with dollars that aren't general fund, I think I would take a different look at it. But, you know, this time around, I mean, there's going to be a lot of good programs that we're going to have to make hard choices and say, we just simply can't afford them this next biennium if they're funded by general fund dollars. And this is one of them. I mean, in my opinion, I'm going to have to say, no, we can't afford this. It's a great program. It probably does what it's supposed to do. But, you know, there's nice and there's necessary.
Senator Musker, do you have any?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, following up to some of the comments made by the committee, I think it's important, above all, to manage the distinction between the funding of the program and the legislation that this continues, in terms of the measurements that we have asked, and this is an update of those measurements. Now, certainly, the Ways and Means Committee, as we move to conclusion of the session, will decide ultimately what dollars, if any, go to any particular program. But I think it's incumbent on us to make sure that, as following the legislative intent of what this program does and updating that, that we ensure that the program is written and is sustainable and meets the objectives that we have given to the department, and it still will have that determination as to whether it's ultimately funded in another vehicle. But this is the policy vehicle of how that should be written, and I think it's and I would, you know, compliment those, you know, who have advanced this, and I know it came originally from legislative direction, is to be able to measure the outcomes of our workforce development. And, so, you know, I think we have two different discussions here, but for this purpose, you know, I think this is an important update, is to make sure it's true to the charge that we have given the Employment Department.
Further comment? Mm-hmm. I believe it was, we'll close a public hearing and not go into a work session at this time. There's a couple of reasons for that, just so we have some more clarification and maybe we can get Senator Byers' comfort level up a little higher, but also to send a message. I mean, part of our charge has been to try and work with the ways and means process, and what Senator Byers has said is absolutely what they're telling us. Is, you know, these are maybe the very good program, but is it something that we can really afford at this particular time? So what we do, my intent is to close the public hearing and not go into work session this time, but keep this process going.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 250, and thank you very much for coming in. Proposed amendment there. Okay, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 252. Dennis.
Senate Bill 252 conforms insurance privacy notice to federal privacy notice requirements. Provides for notice at initiation of an insurance transaction. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there is an amendment.
Carl, and bring up wherever you want to. Please introduce yourself and commence.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Insurance Administrator for the Department of Business and Consumer Services. To my right is Lewis Little-Hales, Program Executive. I'm here to ask for your support on Senate Bill 252, which was introduced at the request of the Department of Business and Consumer Services. Senate Bill 252 addresses various insurance issues and clarifies existing regulatory powers. The insurance division worked with the insurance companies and insurance agent organizations and other interested parties to develop this bill. There are seven major parts to this bill, and I'll explain them in order. The first one deals with privacy regulation. And this allows an insurer, the current law allows for a single notice. And that's confusing because the privacy notice really deals with two separate times. And this bill allows for insurers to issue two separate notices to consumers. One at the time that the insurance transaction is being entered into, and the second to describe how these personal financial information is used during the insurance relationship. The second part deals with insurance holding company requirements, and they're made applicable to health service contractors, which are like Regents, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and Kaiser Permanente. This part of the bill requires that the healthcare service contractors be treated the same as insurers with regards to the notice to the insurance division about transactions between its members, and it also subjects the healthcare service contractors to the same standards that are applied to insurers with regards to investments in its subsidiaries. The third piece deals with the designation of the title insurance commissioner. Current law clearly allows the director of the department to delegate duties that she sees fit to whomever. But the question about the title of insurance commissioner is not real clear. This bill allows the director to send the title with the duties if she decides to do so. The fourth piece deals with recording of complaints. The current law uses the word written complaints. Through this change in the bill, we're asking that the legislature make it clear that it is desirable to record all complaints that come into the insurance division. We believe that this is a consumer-friendly practice and that we should record all complaints. The fifth piece of the bill deals with the timeliness for review of acquisitions and mergers. This bill requires that the insurance division apply the same time for acquisition and mergers for between insurers as is allowed for the processing of acquisition and mergers between affiliates of holding companies. The sixth piece deals with the application of standardized statutory accounting principles. And it corrects a problem that was created in the 2001 legislation, which implemented standardized statutory accounting principles. This change corrects the problem so as to make it very clear that the statutory standardized accounting principles apply to the financial accounting that insurers do, and that it does not apply to the content of the insurer's forms that they send out to their consumers. The seventh part of the bill deals with exempt insurers. Exempt insurers provide limited insurance products to their members. There are currently four exempt insurers, two of which are domestic and two of which are foreign. This bill makes it very, very clear that the existing exempt insurers retain all of their existing status and powers. But since there's really not any reason to continue with exempt insurers, it does away with that concept, and if there were an application for a similar kind of business in the future, it would be subject to the entire insurance code, which protects the insurance buying public in a better way. The last part I'd like to mention is that there is a proposed amendment to the delegation of authority of our delegation of the title of insurance commissioner, and these amendments to that part of the bill make it clear that the delegation of the title insurance commissioner has nothing to do with the workers' compensation laws. It deals with the insurance code and not workers' compensation. We hope the committee will favorably consider this bill and move that the bill and its amendments be sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Do you have any questions I can answer?
Just on this proposed amendment, do you want to explain exactly which agenda you've just deleted?
Yes, we're just deleting the term workers' compensation from the language so that all that will be left is the insurance.
Okay, and then... And serve under the supervision control of the director. That's another.
That's correct. That's just to make it clear that that when the title goes, it's still subject to the control of the director of DCBS. That this is not altering any of the powers or anything. It's really just a clarification, which came up when we started looking at delegation of the duties and then the title, and then there was a question about just how that. The law actually read, and this is an attempt to clarify that so that it's clear that the director has the authority to make the delegations that she deems are appropriate.
Okay, that's good. And under number four, when you have the written and signed complaint received, but you also complaints are received electronically by telephone, is there some requirement that you determine who the complainant is, address, I mean, so it's not an anonymous?
Right. We do determine that, and we do actually make these records today, but the way that the law has been drafted, it only applies to written complaints, and we felt that it would be better to have a direction from the legislature telling us that it is in fact desirable that we keep track of all the complaints that are processed by the insurance division, but we do apply, you know, some criteria. We do have to know who's making the complaint and that sort of thing, and that's all.
Any questions from the committee? Yes, sir. Senator Metz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the first aspect of your changes, and you say in your written testimony on page 2 that one of the changes is necessary because the current state notice informs the consumer of the insurer's information gathering practices at the outset of the insurance transaction. The federal one is the ongoing relationship. Would you give me just a few examples of the state notice in terms of consumers informing a consumer of the insurer's information gathering practices? What are some of the gathering practices that I would be informed of? What does the state currently require of that?
Could I ask Mr. Littlehales to respond to that, Chairman?
Sure, yeah, just introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Lewis Littlehales, and I'm with the Insurance Division. My title is Program Executive. The kind of information that's given at that time is the... Um, whether it informs the person whether personal information may be collected from persons other than the individual or from public sources. Also the types of personal information that may be collected and the types of sources and investigative techniques that may be used. Also the types of disclosures that are permitted and the kinds of disclosures that may be made without prior authorization.
Okay, so it informs the consumer of both the information that they will gather to make insurance decisions as well as who they can give that information to
yes.
May be requested.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? If not, we'll thank you, gentlemen, very much for coming, and we'll close the public hearing and go into a work session here. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 252, open up a work session on Senate Bill 252. Comments are from the committee. Seems to be pretty much of a...
Well, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments then to Senate Bill 252.
Okay, very good. Any comment or discussion on moving the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 252? None. Any objection? Please note the Senator Meyer is missing and was excused. So we adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 252 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Okay, Senator Meska moves Senate Bill 252 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Any discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass. All right.
Just
we'll wait for Senator Meyer to get back in there.
Which one?
252, the insurance bill.
Yeah, we have some people out
here. Yeah.
And just for the record, I should note that we had another person sign up, one John Powell, who said insurers are in support of this. So
you got him up here to say that, right?
No, he didn't. He didn't want to say that.
He doesn't like to come in front of me because then I ask him questions.
So we have passed the amendment. We're just now asking that this be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. If there is no disagreement amongst the committee or concerns the committee, we'll pass another the consent calendar. Any discussion? No objections? So ordered. Closed public hearing. Let's see. Who? Senator Messman, you want to carry that one?
Sure.
Okay. And so we will close the work session on Senate Bill 252. And there's no other matters coming before the committee. Any discussion from the committees? Any comments? Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was out in the hall actually getting more information on Senate Bill 250 from the Employment Department out there. And what they informed us was that if we do not pass this bill, the system does not go away. It will still be running two systems. But what they're going to be doing is they're going to be looking to see if there is some way that these other agencies can get their general fund dollars out of the system so that we can't. They can be no general fund dollars in support of the system. So that's just an update. That's why I was out in the hall. Just out there, you know.
Okay. Well, we'll just let the
action for a good purpose.
The pots simmer a little bit, and I think things will work out here. So, all right. No further business coming before the committee. We will close the public hearing for today for the Committee on Business and Labor.